Hello. This podcast is available unedited and ad-free at patreon.com/HamiltonMorris. Each month, I release 3 to 4 new podcasts, and it was Patreon exclusive until recently. Many people contacted me and said they wanted me to figure out a way to make it freely available, and so I decided to accept sponsorship from a few of my friends. One of them is David Rentlin, the founder of a company called Lucy Nicotine. They make nicotine gum, nicotine pouches, nicotine lozenges, some of which are made with synthetic nicotine, which I think is pretty cool. Now, if you don't already use nicotine, I recommend that you don't start. It's habit forming. But if you already do use nicotine products, and especially if you smoke tobacco cigarettes, I can say that this is a cleaner product. And it's also a product that I use personally. If you go to lucy.co and use the code Hamilton, you get 20% off your purchase. Lastly, this podcast is brought to you by Top Tree Herbs, an herbal tea company founded by my friend and pharmacopoeia producer, Soren Shade. This is not a traditional sponsorship in that I'm not receiving any money from them, but Soren is actually a producer on this podcast. They grow their own kratom domestically in Appalachia in a greenhouse, which is very beautiful. And they source leaves internationally, do third-party testing. I've been to the lab where they do the testing. They test for heavy metals and other adulterants, and it's ethically sourced in tea bag form. You can find their teas at toptreeherbs.com. Okay, this is an interview with the great Samuel D. Bannister, or SDB. I remember the first time Sam Bannister reached out to me in 2015, he wrote me a Facebook message, and I thought, no way. Is this the real SDB? Because I've been following his work for a long time. He's a big name in cannabinoid research. I mean, he's one of very few people who has an entire class of cannabinoids bearing his initials. SDB-001, or APICA, is, I think, the first synthetic cannabinoid that contained an adamantyl substituent anywhere in the molecule. It's a really interesting structure, and although I'm ashamed to admit I have never used it, I've heard that it also happens to be qualitatively one of the best synthetic cannabinoids, and that's coming from people who really knew what they were talking about, specifically the pharmacologist who is in charge of the R&D at Matt Bowden's Stargate synthetic cannabinoid company. This guy had tried, I don't even know, 50, 60, 70 different synthetic cannabinoids, and he said that SDB-001 was possibly the finest that he ever tried. And I don't think that's what Sam Bannister was trying to do necessarily. He's probing the structure-activity relationship and exploring the chemistry, but it seems like he stumbled upon a very good one, and it bears his initials. So during the interview, we go into some of the burdens associated with being a medicinal chemist, inventing drugs that appear on the gray market or eventually black market, and the ethics of doing that and the emotional burden of being involved with it. This is a really far-ranging, interesting conversation with one of the great chemists and pharmacologists involved with psychoactive drug research today. I can't overemphasize how important his contributions are. This guy has so many publications. He has great reviews that have been published in the Dark Classics and Chemical Neuroscience series. He's published lots and lots of original research, and now he's the co-founder of a psychedelic pharmaceutical company called Silo. So he's doing all kinds of interesting work. And I'm also glad to talk about synthetic cannabinoids because I find them fascinating. Most people, when they talk about synthetic cannabinoids, it's just bad. It's like the same way that people talk about fentanyl. Like, this is a terrible thing that emerged out of prohibition. And there is a dimension of that that is true. I think for the average person, synthetic cannabinoids were an unequivocally bad thing. But for the responsible connoisseur, they were an amazingly weird and interesting part of drug history. I don't think I'm alone. Maybe I am alone in having been totally thrilled by the mystery involved with getting these little packets of various synthetic cannabinoid blends and bringing them to the lab and analyzing them. Each packet was like a little analytical mystery, and the fun of figuring out what the synthetic cannabinoid was. And this is, of course, before they were illegal. People would sometimes send me samples and I would go through them and figure out what was inside and then talk to the people about what the effect was and what they thought of it. And I just loved that. Even the art on the bags was something that I loved. I collected the bags because they used to be all over the street in Brooklyn. A friend of mine, Adam Green, said that synthetic cannabinoid bag art was the original NFT. I'm not sure exactly what that means or even what he meant by it, but it rings true. The holographic bloodshot eyes of SpongeBob on bags of Geeked Out staring up at you from gutters in Brooklyn was something that I cherished. And I think that they will be a sort of folk art that one day will be appreciated, much in the same way that the great Mark McLeod has an entire museum of LSD blotter art. There was a time when people thought that that was artistically meaningless and insignificant, and now it's being appreciated. And so I feel the same way about synthetic cannabinoid bags. I mean, seeing them made me feel like I was in a dystopian sci-fi novel, like a Philip K. Dick world. And it was, yeah, it was really interesting. And of course, the history and the progression of them is very complicated. I don't think there have been adequate demographic analyses of how this occurred, because the whole thing was marginalized and demonized, and it just wasn't taken as seriously as it should be. I hope that one day the subject gets the treatment it deserves, because it really was an amazing thing watching it evolve from Spice and K2. I do know one of the original people who worked on K2, and I'm going to interview them in the coming months. I'm starting to schedule that and try to get some of the inside story. I even remember in March of 2011 in Kansas, when I was interviewing Crystal Cole for the Subterranean LSD Palace episode of Pharmacopoeia, that there was someone in her town who was making synthetic cannabinoid blends. And these were like handmade blends where they were just mixing it with a wooden spoon. And the product was called Bless My Soul Berries Potpourri and Swervin'. And just thinking, man, this is weird. And it just continued to grow and grow and grow. And the number of compounds increased, the availability increased, the price dropped, and suddenly they were quite common. Someone even told me that the industry had grown to such an extent that they were tracing synthetic cannabinoid blend manufacturers, not by the synthetic cannabinoids themselves, but via the Damiana trade. They were monitoring Damiana like it was P2P, as strange as that sounds. The other thing that makes me sort of interested in this is, despite the fact that virtually everything you will hear about these substances is negative, I feel conflicted, because I feel like it's my responsibility to first and foremost be honest about things. And the honest reality is that most of my experiences with synthetic cannabinoids were entirely positive. I used them responsibly, I knew the chemical identity of what I was using, and I knew the dose, and I didn't use them regularly. But I tried a good number of them, and I enjoyed all of them. I haven't used a synthetic cannabinoid in many, many years, but I have fond memories of JWH-73 in particular. I even knew a guy who would smoke JWH-73 as if it were 5-MeO-DMT. He would smoke such a high dose that he would lose consciousness entirely, and he thought that that was the appropriate way to use it, and then would reconstruct his personality from scratch in the wake of this flash of hyper-stonedness. Were these compounds as safe as cannabis? Obviously not. They carried all sorts of problems. They killed some people. There were instances of addiction. But we also learned an enormous amount about cannabinoid pharmacology. I mean, even little things that aren't adequately appreciated. Like, it's easy to forget that at the time of the initial reports of cannabinoid-induced hyperemesis disorder, the people didn't know what was causing it. Is it a pesticide that's being used on the cannabis? Is it some contaminant in the cannabis? Is it a fungus growing on the cannabis? What is it in cannabis that is doing this? And it wasn't until people started to experience that same disorder with synthetic cannabinoids that it became clear that this was not a cannabis-specific effect, but this is an effect that impacts many people who continuously administer high-potency CB1 agonists. So yes, they're not as safe, but that also doesn't mean that they're categorically dangerous. I feel the same way about the NBOME compounds, which, like synthetic cannabinoids, are maligned by absolutely everyone in the drug community. And if you hadn't tried one yourself, you would think that they're complete poisons. But, and I feel conflicted about saying that my experiences with them have been positive, but that's the reality. You know, 2,5-C NBOME, if used appropriately at a low measured dose, is an extraordinary psychedelic. So there's a lot of lessons to be learned about synthetic cannabinoids, about research on synthetic cannabinoids, about the medical psychedelic industry, about cubane, about various substituted cubane derivatives. I'm not going to give it away, but there's some doozies in there. And I hope you really enjoy this conversation, because I love Samuel Banister. I think that he's an inspirational chemist. I think he's done some really amazing work. I'm going to attach links to his papers in the description, and I hope you enjoy this conversation. This podcast is also brought to you by The Apollo. The Apollo is a wearable, vibrating bracelet or anklet that appears to be able to modulate your consciousness. And when I first heard about this thing, I was very skeptical. I was at a conference and met a psychiatrist and neuroscientist named David Rabin, and he had built this prototype and let me wear it for a night. During the entire night, I felt very calm and euphoric and good. And I thought, okay, well, maybe this is just placebo. But I also told him that if he ever built more of them, I'd really like to try it again. So he sent me one, and now I've used it for hundreds of hours. It's a very versatile, wearable device that they are selling for stress relief, but you can modulate the frequency of the vibrations to create either a stimulating or calming effect. You can actually sleep wearing it and it seems to help sleep, or you can change the frequency and it has a sort of stimulating effect, which I sometimes use while I'm on a long drive. I've tried a lot of these different non-pharmacological means for alteration of consciousness, like binaural beats and various types of stroboscopic visual stimulation. Usually I'm skeptical of this sort of thing, but this tactile modulation of mood actually does seem to work. The idea being that it delivers a gentle, soothing vibration that conditions your nervous system to recover and rebalance after stress. That's the idea. It's sort of like a vibrating chair or strapping a purring kitten to your leg. If you find a purring kitten calming, then I think you would also find this calming. It's a similar sort of phenomenon. If you're interested in getting one of these devices, you can go to apolloneuro.com to read more about it and use the promo code Hamilton for 10% off. Thank you, Apollo. All right. It has begun. What are you up to? I've followed your work for a really long time. I was a fan of your work when you contacted me. You're one of few people that has drugs with their initials in them that are...
You're making me blush.
you've invented drugs that have Wikipedia entries. You've done some really amazing work from a chemistry perspective, from a pharmacology perspective, and in terms of their impact on the drug market. I mean, it's like it kind of ticks all the boxes. So I'm curious how you got into all this.
Oh, that's a good question. And I've related to a few people sort of privately, but I don't think I've ever spoken about it too publicly. But yeah, I say I became a sort of accidental psychoactives chemist. And so, I mean, I was always interested in human consciousness. That's what led me to study sort of pharmacology and chemistry, even as, you know, a teenager and then an undergraduate. And, you know, I ended up pursuing a degree in chemistry to develop drugs because I became really interested in that. But then in, I think it was 2013, I'd been contacted by, I was working as a research associate. I had my PhD already and I was developing radio traces to image brain inflammation. But I got contacted by a colleague at a federal drug laboratory here, and I knew them from my undergrad days, and they knew that my PhD had focused on a class of molecules that are polycyclic amines that included this particular modified compound of which the core was an adamantane. So this federal drug lab in Australia had seized about 100 grams of this white powder, and they'd done a presumptive sort of structural analysis. They thought they knew what it was. And it was the compound that the structure they come up with is the compound that ended up being called AB001. So they asked me
Remind
if,
me what that is.
So if you're familiar with JWH018, if you replace the naphthalene unit with an adamantane group, that's AB001. So it's an indole, a one pentyl indole, with a ketone at the three position as the bridge, and then an adamantane instead of a naphthalene.
Got it.
Yeah, so it's a pretty interesting little molecule. They asked, this is a lab that's used to seeing importation of steroids and amphetamines. They did a search for it. It had no record in any of the common chemical databases. So they asked me if we could do a sort of structural confirmation and figure out what it may have been imported for. And very quickly you find out through sort of substructure analysis that it looks a lot like JWH018. So I let them know that maybe it was a cannabinoid. We screened it at CB1 and CB2 receptors, so the two main cannabinoid receptors for those who are not familiar with them. And it had some activity in our assay, our flipper assay, but not very potent. And so we set about doing a little bit of SAR because not much had structure activity relationship work because not much had been done for this series. And we looked at common things, what happens if we change the ketone to an amide? What happens if we change the adamantane to a smaller alicyclic group? Really common med chem stuff. The interesting thing was that we made a series of these things. We made the 5-fluoropentyl derivatives as well, because I'd seen in some of the literature that there was emerging sort of compounds that had this design element where you take the terminal point of that pentyl chain and put a fluorine atom on there. So we published, we gave them the same sort of naming format that JWH018 for your listeners is the initials of John Huffman at Clemson University, who designed a lot of these original compounds back in the day. So, a little bit tongue in cheek, I kept the same kind of naming format and I just called these things SDB001 through 12. The first six being the desfluoro cases and the next six being the fluorinated analogs. So we'd done all this work. We'd spent a lot of time looking at the pharmacology of these compounds. Interestingly, they didn't do much in mice in terms of a typical cannabinoid-like profile. So they didn't seem to be very potent in vivo. And we thought it was worth publishing this work. So we submitted just the first six compounds, synthesis and characterization, to ACS Chemical Neuroscience. And that was published, I'm trying to think here, I think it was published online in April 2013. Didn't really think much more about it, hadn't been working on that project any longer. And then I got an email from the European Monitoring Centre for Drugs and Drug Addiction. So via their early warning system, they'd emailed me saying they had a detection of three new substances. It's pretty unusual to get an email from a sort of major organisation in Europe where the CC line is just filled with the heads of policing for Europol and other various federal policing agencies. A little bit scary, but they were seeking additional information and sort of announcing that they detected these two substances. And so they detected SDB006, which we had published, but what was really interesting is they detected 5F SDB006, which I'd coded SDB012. So I think it was about a kilogram of each that had been seized by Finnish customs and passed on to Finnish police out of Hong Kong. That's where they've been shipped from. So this was around October 2013. So in that intervening period, just sort of 6 months, someone somewhere in the world has read our paper, has thought about the sort of structure activity relationships that we've reported. They've designed, I mean, they've replicated some of the work we've done, but then also designed new compounds using that information, had a kilogram of a couple of these things manufactured and then sent to Europe, presumably for distribution and sale. So it's a pretty unusual thing. It was like, at the time I was kind of pretty scared and just like a little bit concerned. And it ended up informing a lot of the work that I did in this area later on. So, thinking about the relationship between sort of scientific research and public good and what obligation does a scientist have in terms of sharing knowledge and potentially causing harm by releasing information about new drugs. So I continued working on this area for a number of years after that, including with sort of US government organizations and Australian government organizations. And the sort of working principle became that we would, which is very unusual for academia, we actually wouldn't publish a lot of our results. So we'd continue making these things and exploring them, looking at them as reference standards to try and see which compounds were appearing in the marketplaces, but not actually publishing a lot of that information in case we sort of gave away key structure activity insights to people who are designing these things.
That is, why would you do that? What was, did you, I'm curious, because that's, like you said, it's very much against the typical scientific tendency, which is to make knowledge available. I mean, did you want to do that?
Yeah, it was sort of a personal decision after a discussion with some colleagues of mine. And it's not that we wouldn't be able to publish it, it's that we could always publish the information as needed after the fact, after these things have been detected. But what really, early on, these compounds, these synthetic cannabinoids, which have existed since about 2008 in Germany, is sort of the first assumed emergent state. Early on, at least, they weren't especially acutely toxic, it seemed. A lot of them were appearing pretty rapidly every year. And then at some point, they transitioned to a sort of series of analogs derived from a couple of key patents from Pfizer in 2009. So Pfizer was looking for new analgesics with CB1 activity. And at some point, all of these synthetic cannabinoids that are being released were based on these two patents. They had the same design elements. So these sort of pendant amides with amino acid, amide or ester side chains. And these compounds seem to be much more acutely toxic than the earlier examples. And you got to a point where in the US you were, routinely having mass intoxication events of 100 or more people. There'd be fatalities. It was the US and elsewhere, actually. It was all over the world. And at that point, it became, I think there is some sort of obligation to think about the nature of the work that you're publishing potentially.
Yes, although I do think that to view the hospitalizations and deaths as a pure function of the chemicals might be neglecting to recognize all of the social factors that play into hospitalizations and deaths with these substances.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Because I think we talked many years ago when there was a spate of hospitalizations in Russia from MDMB Fubinica. Do you remember this?
Yeah, I do.
And there were a number of notices that were published in Russia about how this is immensely dangerous. And of course, my first thought was, okay, well, I absolutely must acquire some of this chemical and try it. And not because, I have a death wish or anything like that, but because I was curious, is this an intrinsic toxicological property of MDMB Fubinica, or is this a cultural product of a market that has emerged where people are using excessively high doses that are unmeasured of a compound and that these people don't know what they're getting into either? That they are using it without any knowledge of what they're doing. And my own experiences with MDMB Fubinica, which I used with extreme caution. I mean, I started working up from, I think, maybe 20 micrograms. Really, I was extremely cautious because what I'd read was alarming. And although I'm aware of how much propaganda surrounds the world of drugs, there's also the unfortunate reality that drugs actually can be dangerous and toxic. And I was trying to recognize that. But in my limited experience, once I did get it up to an active dose, which I think was maybe a couple hundred micrograms, don't quote me on that, there was nothing about it that struck me as different from the other synthetic cannabinoids that I'd tried. It didn't, suddenly turn me into a homicidal maniac, or I didn't become addicted to it or anything of that nature. And so I think what happened with a lot of these compounds is, one, a huge market emerged that didn't exist. So you're saying in 2006 that these early compounds like JWH-18 or JWH-73 were less toxic. And that seems to be the consensus among many people. And it very well may be true. But I also wonder if the market was fundamentally different at that time. You
Oh, yeah.
had just a smaller number of people using these things. They were not as widely available. They were not available in bodegas, at least in the United States. Then fast forward to maybe 2014, they are widely available in bodegas. They're being used by homeless people, by people who are really kind of living difficult, fringe existences, maybe, a lot of the same sorts of people who might be, inhaling spray paint or things like that, people that are already predisposed to dangerous patterns of drug use. And those are the people who are having difficulty with these substances. So I do wonder if the real issue with some of these things was that the type of user changed, that the original people who were selling them changed, right? Because you had this initial group of people who were selling spice who were doing this probably with some degree of caution. I mean, it wasn't even clear at the beginning whether this would be a market. I remember seeing discussions around 2006 or 2007 with people on internet forums saying things like, I read a paper and there's all these synthetic cannabinoids. Why doesn't anybody ever sell those? And people say, well, why would anyone sell a synthetic cannabinoid? Cannabis is available all over the place. It would be pointless. Why would you go to the trouble of synthesizing a cannabinoid when you can just get cannabis? And that seemed like a logical response at that time. But man, was it wrong. It was about as wrong can be.
I'm going to pause momentarily for an ad. This podcast was brought to you by Matcha.com, a source of high-quality, heavy metal-tested matcha from Japan. They also now make a freeze-dried matcha cube that they are calling Space Matcha that is very delicious. It dissolves instantly in water, and you can even pop it directly into your mouth. It's a very futuristic product. I carry a bag of them in my backpack, and it's a really good way to have matcha on the go. If you visit Matcha.com and use the code Hamilton, you get 20% off any teas that you buy and a free gift. Thank you, matcha.com.
Yeah, you raise, I mean, this is, I very naively had similar thoughts. So you raise a number of really good points here. The first is around the bias in sort of reporting on these substances. So yeah, these aren't like evenly distributed substances that are being used by upper middle class people in their, private time. There is a definite bias in society in terms of the people who are using these products. And I mean, we know that the volume of these substances circulating has increased because you can track some of that data through things like the World Drug Report put out by the UNODC in terms of seizures and other things. So yeah, absolutely, there has been probably an increase in the number of people using them. The comments you made around homogeneity are super important. So those studies have also been done. These products are not very homogenous. They're not professionally manufactured. So thinking about the work that we published about the outbreak in Bedford-Stuyvesant, those materials, so that was AMB Fubinaca and a product called AK-47. For the compounds that were seized, the aliquots out of the sort of same bag, they ranged from about 14 milligrams per gram of cannabinoid material up to about 25 in one of the samples. So yeah, these are not super well formulated materials. And if you have a look at DEA file photos on some of the seizures in the southwest of the United States, people are literally making these things with herbal powders, compound dissolved in acetone, and then blending them up in cement mixes. Like it's pretty comical. It's like almost sort of like the drug war propaganda photos that you see of like ecstasy labs back in the day. But that's sort of how these things are being manufactured. And yeah, in terms of the people using them, one of the really naive thoughts that I had, I mean, I was living in the US as these compounds were a major issue. I was watching a number of states sort of increasingly adopt recreational cannabis laws to allow improved access to cannabis. And this really becomes like a socioeconomic point because I, naively thought that of course, if people can get cannabis, they wouldn't use these substances. And that's certainly been the case in Australia. They were used by people who were drug tested for employment, for example. But yeah, it was completely naive because these materials are just so cheap. So as the DEA has gone to ban things like AMB Fubinaca, they do their three-factor analysis. And I recall reading one of these documents that they tried to get a quotation for AMB Fubinaca from a Chinese vendor to work out sort of the economics of the situation. And I think the price that was quoted was about $3,000 or $3,500 US for a kilogram of AMB Fubinaca. And this is a material that's active at, as you said, probably a milligram, maybe less in humans. So these are just enormously cost-effective drugs in terms of price per unit dose. You're talking at like less than cents for a unit dose wholesale. So they can never outcompete cannabis amongst, the poorest people in society. And that's, as you identified, that's exactly where you see them being used.
Right.
Have you followed any of Craig McKenzie's work
No.
in the UK prison system?
No.
Yeah, Craig's a great guy. He's working for Chiron now, but he was running a program at the University of Dundee for a long time, looking at spice use in, synthetic cannabinoid use in the UK prison system. And these drugs are just so potent and so inexpensive that prisoners were initially smuggling them in almost like LSD blotter. So they'd have letters where the paper was impregnated with cannabinoid, and then people would use mains electricity from their cells to sort of ignite the paper and inhale the material. So at some point, the prison officers decided that all mail would be scanned and people would receive, scans of letters so that there'd be no chance of them obtaining drugs that way. And the latest I heard from Craig is that as a result, these innovative sort of prison smugglers have now resorted to impregnating clothing. So my understanding is that there are, socks that are impregnated with synthetic cannabinoids, and prisoners are in their cells just, sparking socks with mains electricity to get high. So it's a pretty wild
It
situation.
is a wild situation. And one difference I should point out is duration seemed to change quite a bit. That was one thing that was very different from the first generation, although JWH 18 and 73 had somewhat short durations, but nothing like that compound that came out of Matt Bowden's lab, the fluropentyl indazole cumilamide. What is the trivial name for
Right,
that?
right.
SGTs.
I don't. The SGT 151, maybe something like this. They have, yeah, that those cumolamide series of compounds. We've done quite a bit of work with those as well. So they induce a sort of conformational preference. We've actually done some pretty interesting work where you have not just the dimethyl case, but each enantiomer of a single methyl group and then no methyl group. So you have some idea of exactly what's controlling the orientation of that benzyl group with respect to the rest of the molecule in the binding site. And yeah, there's very obvious structural activity trends there with a preference for cumol, followed by the S enantiomer, followed by the R, and then the benzyl in terms of potency. So they seem to be just very well optimized for the right sort of conformational restriction in terms of engaging the CB1 receptor.
Right. And I think duration is such a crucial component of these things that doesn't get enough attention because I remember it was probably 2000, maybe 2008, 2007, there was a compound CP47497. Well, actually, okay, it was actually being,
Yeah.
yeah, it was being, I think it was being sold as CP55940, but it was in reality, this was before I had access to analytical instruments, so I actually don't know exactly what it was. It, in all likelihood, was the C8 CP47497. That would be my guess, but who knows? Whatever it was outrageously potent and had an extremely, extremely long duration. I think it was maybe 3 days before I was completely down from the experience. And
Wow.
yeah,
What was the route of
oral.
administration? Right.
Yeah. And all it takes is one of those, and you never want to do it again. Even if the experience is kind of okay or neutral, you still just don't ever want to do that again. Whereas with the SGT 145, was it? Or what I
I said 151. Let me look it up
151.
for factual accuracy
Yeah,
here.
okay.
5F-cumol-Panaca is the other code, right? SGT25.
SGT25.
Yep.
Yeah. So yeah, with SGT25, the crack comparison actually seems somewhat fair. I mean, you smoke this stuff, you get incredibly stoned, and within half an hour, you're back to baseline. So that
Yeah, right.
promotes a pattern of repeated compulsive consumption that probably reinforces some pattern of addiction. And those did seem to be the compounds where people really got into trouble.
Oh, absolutely. I think I haven't looked in a lot of detail at those compounds specifically, but cannabis itself, just via Delta 9 THC, for people who are dependent on that, it has sort of a spot, it has aspects of a spontaneous withdrawal syndrome, and it's often sort of GI upset, impaired sleep or sleep dysfunction. And when you get online and read about the effects of, people talk about how they've essentially just been smoking these things all day long for a long time, and when they try to stop taking them, the withdrawal that they describe sounds quite severe. Like sort of, tremors and sweating and heavily disrupted sleep or inability to sleep. So, it starts to sound more like drugs that have a very well characterized sort of withdrawal syndrome that is serious. You know, drugs like, I'm not saying that they are like opioids, but you know, the opioid withdrawal syndrome is widely agreed to be pretty severe, and these compounds start to sound a little bit more like that than, you know, someone giving up cannabis.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So there's all these different factors at play. And I think the duration one is often underappreciated. I was actually talking with William Leonard Picard recently, and he told me that in the 1960s, he half commissioned, half synthesized a synthetic cannabinoid that I think was dimethylheptylpyran. And he had,
Oh yeah, the magical DMH tale.
yeah. He said that he had a academic lab do half of the synthesis. So I'm assuming he had somebody synthesize the 1,2-dimethylheptyl-resorcinol and then maybe did the final condensation with citral or whatever the relevant terpene would be. But he said the duration was monstrously long.
Yeah, I can't recall. Those compounds have been synthesized, a lot of THC type analogs with that sort of tail, and it's actually very similar in a structural biology sense. The way those molecules engage with the receptor draws some parallels to sort of the cumol head group of some of these synthetic cannabinoids. So those geminal dimethyl groups, they do a lot to control the conformation of these sort of lipophilic units, whether it's an aromatic group or a long heptyl chain. And yeah, that's part of the reason they engage so effectively with the receptor. And if you've then optimized them for sort of PK and they're not easily broken down, then you end up with a, you know, very potent drug that's extremely long-lived.
Right. And what I thought was interesting is he reported an experience that was very similar to my own, where he tried it once, it lasted for days, and he decided never again. That's completely undesirable. Why would anyone?
Yeah, it always blew my mind that you know, Shulgin's DO series of compounds, the DOXs, were somewhat popular in the 70s. You know, DOM was sold as in tablet form as STP, and DOB and DOI appear every now and again in illicit drug markets. And these things just, you know, they're reported as very, very potent hallucinogenic agents, very psychedelic agents that last for, you know, 30 hours in some cases. And I just, that's to me sounds like an experience that probably not many people are seeking out.
Yeah, no, I would agree. Are you still doing chemistry?
Yeah. So we're at UNSW with Silo, with this company, building a lab out at the moment, actually.
But at the moment, you're doing contract synthesis with CROs.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. It's all decentralized at the moment.
Yeah. I heard that there's, I imagine you read that letter from the president of Enamine.
I actually haven't yet. I followed a little bit of the Enamine discussion online. It's not great.
Yeah, it's interesting because I wondered how that impacted psychedelic research because so many of these startups are using Enamine to do their research at the moment.
Yeah, no, it's pretty catastrophic. If you follow a lot of you know, Brian Roth's recent work, they're using Enamine real libraries and other things. So yeah, it's kind of the ultimate source of a lot of really interesting chemical matter and synthesis on demand molecules, and that all sorts of groups are using. So yeah, it's going to be pretty disruptive, I think.
Yeah. And just for anyone that doesn't know, Enamine is a contract research organization that's in Ukraine, and it's probably responsible for the production of more chemicals than almost any other CRO that I can think of. It's a huge, huge company. It's really vital to the research of countless labs and companies. And the only reason that it's not impacting me is we have this weird situation where we're trying to avoid CROs entirely and just do everything in-house for better or worse. But that requires working in an academic lab, which is kind of a hassle.
Yeah, definitely pros and cons. I think Enamine has, you know, one of the more interesting libraries of chemical matter. And I was reading a sort of opinion piece on this recently, and a lot of it derives from the very distinct sets of chemical libraries that were being developed in the former Soviet Union versus the Western world. And so the Ukraine and Enamine have inherited a lot of this really interesting chemical matter that's not really replicated in other historical chemical libraries around the world.
Really, like what?
Oh, no specific examples, just that the, you know, the pharmacopoeia for Russia for example, includes a lot of things that were never approved in the US. And there's a lot of really, just really interesting stuff in there.
Yeah, it's crazy to think about all the different drugs that exist in different countries that were never approved in the United States and are still used in other parts of the world or were used and then discontinued. I mean, there's an entire pharmacopoeia of potentially therapeutic drugs that just never trickled down into the US market for whatever reason. Not to mention all of the chemicals that never were approved anywhere that exist in academic labs. I think there's something so tragic about the idea of these labs destroying what they have when they either go out of business or whoever the PI was retires or dies. Like the lab that I'm working at, it's the oldest pharmacy school in the country. And they had a stock room with chemicals that were often well over 100 years old. And then they just threw everything away. Like the entire...
Oh no.
Yeah. Like some, you know, safety person came along and decided that it was irresponsible to keep all these old chemicals. And that was the end of it. It's all gone, probably in a river somewhere.
Yeah. Oh no. Yeah. You'd hope there'd be, you know, a little bit of compound triage or something, that someone would have the time to step in and take a look at individual vials or other things and decide what might be worth keeping for historical reasons or otherwise.
I mean, that was a big part of Aldrich at the beginning, was that Alfred Bader would, you know, buy up collections of various prestigious chemists and would form relationships with people, including clandestine chemists like Steve Gill. Steve Gill was friends with the president of Aldrich.
That's amazing. And I didn't actually know that.
And would make chemicals for him, like as did Daryl Lemaire, as did Shulgin. All of these people were kind of connected because he just saw all these different labs as ways of increasing the diversity of his chemical inventory.
Yeah, that's super interesting.
Yeah. So, but I'm curious what specifically you're working on, if you can talk about that.
Yeah, I can talk a little bit about the history of the company. So we founded Silo with my co-founder Josh sort of July last year. And we're really focused on just next generation psychedelics in a number of different ways. And sort of the unique aspect that we're bringing to this is a combination of sort of computer-aided design that was informed from my postdoc experiences at Stanford. And also just looking into really innovative sort of chemical space. So based on a lot of the new chemical entity work, you know, NCE work that's being done at the moment in this space, I view a lot of it as pretty low-hanging fruit. You know, you've got patents that have been granted in the US at least around mono to per-deuteration of psilocybin with no experimental data. So it's a bit of a chemical space IP land grab at the moment. And we're not so interested in that. We're interested in actually developing highly optimized drugs that ultimately will become best in class for all these emerging indications that people are exploring with psychedelics.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a really cool idea. It does seem interesting to me, though, that in terms of the serotonergic psychedelics that people really use and enjoy, there isn't all that much major chemical diversity. You know, you have ergolines, tryptamines, phenethylamines, and maybe a couple kind of weird variations of those sorts of things, but not all that much that's really far outside the realm of those three scaffolds.
Yeah, I would agree with that entirely. And I think a lot of that is just the history of the field and the way that sort of iterative drug development has been done historically. It makes a lot of sense. You know, when you look at the work that Shulgin was doing, very, very systematic, but minor changes to existing structures. Whereas if you look at other areas of drug development at the moment, you know, if you saw the recent paper from Brian Roth's lab on sigma-2 receptor ligands, you know, we have this vast sort of untapped chemical space available now in the form of the Zinc database at UCSF and elsewhere. So I think it's just that no one's really gone looking yet in a really diligent way. And I think that's all about to change with just the huge improvements in computing power that are only just being sort of realized by this field now.
Yeah, no, I'm very excited. And it was cool to see the ultra LSD process validated with the melatonin receptor ligands that Roth was working on, to see that technique really actually was able to produce some results.
Oh, it absolutely works. I've followed a lot of Brian Roth's work, his work with Choquette and others, and it's pretty incredible. And a number of labs have replicated this general process at other GPCR targets, so that G protein coupled receptor targets. So yeah, I think it's absolutely tractable. The main thing is just defining the sort of threshold where you're likely to get real hits from, sort of false hits, things that are generated in computationally through these ultra large docking campaigns that can then actually be experimentally validated. And there's been huge improvements in that space, even by Roth and others.
Well, given that this has been around for a little while and that there's been success at other receptors, why hasn't anybody published anything in terms of novel 5-HT2A scaffolds?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I'm not entirely sure. I think it's just that people have been focused on other therapeutic targets. If you think about how this sort of renaissance of interest in psychedelic mechanisms of action and 2A and other related receptors as drug targets, it's really just that it's a super new area. People certainly have done it for 2A antagonists, as antipsychotics. They've definitely done it for other 5-HT receptor subtypes. So I really think it's just that historically, looking for, if you're a pharma company, you would not be looking for 5-HT2A agonists because that would be a development liability in terms of causing hallucinations and other, other development errors. So, yeah, I think it's just that the resurgence of interest in psychedelics generally has led to people now starting to look at this technology, which is already proven for other 5-HT subtypes at the 2A receptor and other receptors.
Yeah, and I do wonder. I mean, of course, I agree traditionally that would be an undesirable type of activity, but given that the market seems pretty enormous, it's sort of surprising that things have remained as fringe as they have. I mean, everyone's wringing their hands about corporatization, but what about, if Pfizer or one of the real actual big pharma companies becomes interested in this? I mean, I think it will quickly make the concerns that people have over MAPS or Compass seem small by comparison.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I don't subscribe to a lot of those arguments. I think they're generally quite poorly informed, I think, and it's a lot of the arguments arise out of this, general anti-pharma sentiment within the population, which is born out of some legitimate concerns, but doesn't really sort of appreciate the complexity of this enormous industry. And I think you're right, Hamilton. It's only a matter of time. So, Otsuka, for example, has got a partnership now with a startup in this space. $5 million partnership to co-develop some drugs, and they've had other partnerships prior, I believe, with other psychedelic companies quite recently. So I think it's only a matter of time before, the traditional big pharmaceutical players get interested in this area again.
Right. Yeah. I wish that people could see this as a good thing. It's kind of amazing to me how negatively received this has been when it is probably the single biggest step forward in every dimension that has happened in my lifetime and probably ever, or at least since the 1960s with psychedelics. I mean, this is has broad implications, not just in medicalization, but in basic scientific research and in terms of its downstream effects on drug policy.
Oh, it's absolutely huge. It will be very hard for current prohibitionist models to survive once something like MDMA or psilocybin is approved by the FDA as a medical therapy. That's going to be very, very hard to sustain, in the current framework. So, yeah, it's got enormous consequences. I don't quite follow all of the arguments that people have in opposition to this, but I think a lot of it is just general sort of, anti-corporate, anti-big pharma sentiment. Yeah, and I think a lot of it is just a little bit misunderstood and misdirected.
Oh yeah, there's so much misunderstanding. I was giving a talk recently at this Horizons conference in New York. I don't know if you're familiar with it. And
I know.
they had contacted me and asked me to talk. It wasn't like I was, begging them to be a part of this. And then after I agreed to do it, the organizer called me and started lecturing me about, all that you were saying. Well, I know the work that you and Jason are doing. Honestly, I think it's the least bad of what Compass is doing at the moment. It's like the least bad? How about not bad at all? Or even why not just go ahead and and say that it's good if you value psychedelic research. And on top of that, he has no idea what kind of work Jason and I are doing. He doesn't know the details. It could actually be the most bad for as far as he knows. But there's this idea that this is all really, really bad. And then he started telling me that the reason that Alexander Shulgin published Peak Hall was to prevent anyone from commercializing his research.
Oh, that's absolutely not true.
100% false. 100% false. And then
Shulgin filed patents on his own compounds many times.
And he said, because Shulgin once spoke at the Horizons conference, so he was suggesting that he somehow knew this as a result of talking to Shulgin. But everyone agrees, including Shulgin in his own description of his motivations, that this is not the case. He would have loved to have the work that he was doing commercialized. He wanted that. He wanted it in terms of he wanted these substances to be available as medicines more than he valued some kind of anti-corporate. I don't even know what the alternative model is, really, because I don't think I've ever seen a framework, including the black market and indigenous use, that doesn't involve the transfer of money in exchange for services.
Oh, maybe a Burning Man, but that's about it.
Oh, Burning Man, that's right. Yeah,
that's about the only place where there are, you know, decommodified drugs used as recreationally or as medicines. Really, as far as I'm concerned, there's always some exchange of money for these goods or services. It's unavoidable.
Yeah, I can't say that the Burning Man model is is the the one that I think that's even worse. But
there's an interesting case actually. There's only one drug that was brought to market without a huge amount of commerce by a nonprofit, and that was a drug for a rare disease in Africa that was, I believe, the trials were funded by the Gates Foundation. So this is an area where, you know, no other drug development company was really focused on this area because it's obviously a small market, but the Gates Foundation were able to fund those trials. And I think what a lot of people don't appreciate is just how expensive it is to bring a drug to market. So you can, depending on who you look at, in terms of the analysis, you know, the numbers that are thrown around currently are about $1.3 billion to bring a drug to market. And that includes incorporation of all the costs of failed programs, some of which can be enormous. You know, if you look at the amount that's been spent on looking for new treatments for Alzheimer's disease, for example, I don't think there's, you know, any sort of human activity in the world really that is probably as challenging, as lengthy, and as expensive as drug development in terms of developing a single product for a consumer. It's just unlike a lot of other businesses, and people don't really appreciate that. I think it's because it's tied to this idea that, you know, health is a human right, which absolutely it is. But drugs cost a lot of money to develop. And I think my personal feeling is that a lot of this anger that's directed towards pharma should really be directed towards the health insurers, because they're the people who really gouge the system the most. They add the least value and they drive prices up for both manufacturers and for consumers.
Agreed. Yeah. The entire medical system is really messed up in the United States, but also it's like all this, it's very complicated. You could go somewhere like Mexico, where I think they actually have a much smarter system where pharmacists are empowered to prescribe medications that are not controlled substances, which already I think is just a vast improvement over our current system. So if you need an antibiotic or a skin cream or anything that isn't a controlled substance, you just go to a pharmacist and they will help you with that. And that leaves doctors available to not just be drug dealers, but to actually treat disease. Like that, just that small modification already makes things so much better. And then means that they don't have to book their schedule with 500 weird 2-minute visits that they then bill for who knows how much money. Like the whole thing is really broken. And
of course, I mean, not to cut you off, but I mean, pharmacists would absolutely know more about drugs generally than most, you know, your average PCP or what we call a GP in Australia would, for sure.
Oh, absolutely. And they've been relegated to this completely menial work that really shouldn't even be done by humans. I mean, it should be completely automated. They just fill bottles with pills. That's all they're really allowed to do. All that education to do nothing.
Exactly. Yeah, I used to teach a lot into the undergraduate pharmacy courses at the University of Sydney, and you know, really, really clever people who end up knowing, you know, far more than most people ever know about drugs, about their pharmacology, about their interactions, and their relevance to human disease. And then you take this high-paying job where essentially you're a glorified shopkeeper handing out prepackaged boxes. It's kind of really a bizarre situation.
Yeah, I mean, it's and I think what worries me is when people get too angry about the wrong problem, then they are just fighting something that not only could be helping them, they're also ignoring the real problems. So when the DEA recently moved to schedule five psychedelics, I didn't see a tenth as much of the outcry, not even a, really 1/100 of the outcry that people did over the possibility that one pharmaceutical company might temporarily be able to prevent another pharmaceutical company from selling psilocybin as a treatment for depression for a confined period.
Yeah, that's the thing. Patents have a lifetime, right? They're a period of exclusivity, and then that knowledge is given back to humanity. That's part of the patent structure. It's really a strange position. People have a lot of misdirected anger, I think.
Yeah, and what they say is, well, it prevents competition. And then that is true. But then I say, well, what competition are you talking about? Because, like you said, this is going to cost $1 billion or more. So it's not like you or me or any small group is going to do this. The only competition is going to be a rival group of multimillionaires or billionaires. That's the only way that this can even happen to begin with. So
Yep,
then it's like, what you really
exactly.
want to protect, like it's so important to you that two groups of billionaires simultaneously get to sell psilocybin right off the bat. Like that's your number one priority, is making sure that there's equity among the billionaires for the first 5 years. Like it just seems so misguided. And I don't even like, it would be one thing if all these people worked at a competing pharmaceutical company. Then I get it. Like I understand why people at Usona might be pissed at Compass. That makes total sense to me. But why the average person would be?
Yeah. I mean, we pay so much for drugs that are truly life-saving already, and people do these huge economic analyses, on things like hepatitis C treatment that's curative, very expensive, and insurers largely and the market have priced it a certain way, but it's curative. It's not something that you have to take every day as a treatment for hepatitis C. So there are these like economic considerations around quality of life adjustments and extension of human life and disease-free living that are super important. And my main argument would be that we have tons of treatments in neuropsychiatry already that, a bunch of people are taking that don't really work. Like, wouldn't you be happy maybe to pay in some way for a truly revolutionary new treatment for things like depression?
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's then there's part of me that wonders if there's something fundamentally anarchic about psychedelics. It seems like every attempt that has been made historically to harness their power has been met with some kind of unintended consequences. I mean, this certainly happened in the 1960s. And I don't think Sandoz could have predicted what would have happened. I don't think that Upjohn, when they were doing research on psychedelics, would have predicted. I think this just has a sort of historical tendency to go in directions that nobody anticipates.
Yeah, I think that's true. It does seem to be sort of a fundamental character, I guess, of the effects of these substances is that they are, in terms of the effects that they have on the human mind, it doesn't seem necessarily compatible with some of the models that exist in sort of capitalist marketplaces these days.
Yeah, I'm really curious to see what's going to happen. I mean, is there something that specifically that you're hoping to achieve? Like, it's depression that's your focus?
Yeah, we're focused on depression for a number of reasons. I think it's one of these areas that everyone has been impacted by, either directly or indirectly. Writer's Silo was founding. I'm actually one of my really close friends from Sydney, one of the few people that I knew from Sydney before I moved to the US who was still here. He actually killed himself back in February of last year. So, this is he was on SSRIs, clearly not working very well. So this is an enormous unmet need. Most people do not respond that well to the first antidepressant that they are prescribed. They end up going through a whole cycle of these things. In a lot of cases, it's truly refractory. And for the most severe sorts of depressive disorders, most medicines don't work. So we really do need a fundamentally new way of thinking about this.
Yeah, I do agree. It's definitely worth a shot. I mean,
Yeah, all we can do is try, right? And I think This is recognized to be an enormous unsolved problem, and that's why there is so much, call it hype, but I would call it sort of optimism or hope. There's a huge amount of hope invested in this space that we will have fundamentally new treatments for a lot of very serious mental illnesses.
Yeah, so I wanted to just maybe take a step back because, and I think that the perspective that you had, you mentioned feeling afraid when you got this email that stated compounds that you had created were appearing on the gray market. I mean, what was the fear? What was going through your head when you saw that?
Oh, it's just the idea that you may be responsible for, harm to another person, and that this may be, prosecuted in a legal sense, purely to make an example out of you. I mean, we've already seen this with other aspects of the drug war. And actually, right before I moved back from the US, I'd been working with someone at a, let's not name the government agency, but I've been working with a person at this government agency. We've been doing a lot of this prophetic cannabinoid work. And I got a rather bizarre call from this person where they essentially accused me. They thought they'd found a metabolite with another collaborator that we were working with, a metabolite of something, one of these prophetic cannabinoids that we had generated a reference standard for. And, not in so many words, sort of accused me of maybe being responsible for the death of three teenagers in Texas. And that's like a pretty scary call to get from someone who works for a, very serious government agency when you think you've been doing good work with them. For human benefit. And ultimately it turned out that it was a little overzealous. The metabolite was not anything that I'd ever worked on. And I remember feeling pretty, didn't really sleep very well for a few days after that. And when I eventually confronted this person about it once I was back in Australia, they told me that in fact, they did not represent their employer, and this was their own personal, by email. They did not represent their employer. This was their own personal feeling on the matter. They don't recall the conversation, and sincere apologies if there was any harm caused. Pretty weird, man. Pretty weird.
Yeah, but I can understand how it would be emotional. I remember calling John W. Huffman early on, maybe a couple months after the presence of JWH-18 in Spice had been published. And I remember his wife picked up the call and she sounded kind of giddy and elated by the attention that he was getting. And he, gave me this sort of standard answer of, well, this is for scientific research and I never intended for anybody to use these things and I don't approve of it. And which I'm sure was true. But it seemed, at least from his wife, it sounded like there was maybe a tiny hint of excitement that this work that probably he assumed would never have any major impact on the world suddenly is all over the news and is impacting the lives of tens, maybe hundreds of thousands, and eventually millions of people.
It's a really strange position for an academic chemist to be in. I think most academic chemists that the really purely academic types, whether they're interested in sort of notionally in drug development or not, I don't think anyone really expects that molecules they work on, generally to sort of probe the function of a receptor or to explore structure activity relationships in a very niche class of molecules. I don't think anyone expects those molecules will escape the confines of their lab and definitely not into the sort of illicit drug markets. If anything, you're kind of optimistic that, eventually something will be interesting enough for a small pharma company to develop into a medicine. But yeah, no one really expects it to go the other way, I think. I think we spoke about this when you'd spoken to John Huffman. He was at one point getting, the parents of kids who'd been hospitalized or killed by these substances sort of blaming him for their creation, which is just way out of line.
Absolutely. And I saw an article that came out maybe 5 or 6 years after I spoke to him. And it was clear that whatever initial excitement, and he didn't express any excitement at all, but I could tell that there was maybe just a hair of, and I don't blame him at all. I don't think there's anything wrong with it, but just a tiny hair of like, this is interesting. Whereas, yeah, it seemed like he was really haunted by it later in life. And I think that's totally unreasonable. I mean, I emotions are not necessarily reasonable, but I hope that he doesn't torture himself over these things because I think that it's just a product of doing research and it's not a reasonable way to think about the world.
No, but I think any sort of, moral and ethical human with a conscience thinks about their impact on the world. And, most scientists, I would argue, very few scientists get into science with the view of causing harm. I mean, no one takes what's a very, a career path that's extremely challenging, often pretty lowly paid for the amount of training that you do. No one does this because they're setting out to, harm human society. It's most scientists get into science and research out of a desire to do good, whether it's just informing us about the world around us or, creating drugs that treat human disease. So I can totally understand how you'd be haunted by your creation. I mean, Albert Hoffman's autobiography, right? LSD, Mein Sorgenkind, my problem child. I think even the most interesting sort of chemical inventions probably haunt their inventors to some extent.
Yeah. And one thing that I never see talked about is how, in these contemporary medicalization discussions, all people talk about is IP and who's going to have access and what if there is a monopoly or what if, it's all this sort of business-oriented stuff, which I'm amazed anyone finds interesting. But one thing that nobody ever says, they talk about this like the gray market doesn't exist anymore when it very much does. So if you or I or anyone, Brian Roth, David Olson, anyone, Mike Cunningham, if any of those people come up with something good, the gray market is still there. Nothing is different.
Of
And
course.
if it's really good, someone somewhere is going to make it. And regardless of medicalization, for better or worse, it will end up in the general population.
Exactly. This is a consequence of globalization, not of science. I think that's absolutely right. So one of the interesting things as we were setting up Silo was I went for a quick look at the prior art online, obviously, did it very systematically and diligently in the academic and patent literature. But then I started looking, poking around on Blue Light and, various Reddit sub forums about exactly this topic. What sort of interesting 2A agonists or, putative psychedelics have been reported in the sort of informal scientific space? And yeah, there's tons of info there. People constantly on sites like Blue Light are designing speculative new psychedelics, and that's a really interesting intersection of sort of science and law as well. So, what do those compounds count as prior art? People have proposed the structures, they're not indexed in databases. Often they haven't been synthesized, but yeah, I totally agree that the information itself, once it is released, is absolutely exploitable by anyone. And there is that sort of element of, given how many people are now working in this area, just because company A chooses not to do something, company B almost certainly will come up with some overlapping elements of design in some of their molecules as well, and then that will cause leakage to the gray market. Yeah, the gray market hasn't gone away. I think we've only just got a number of international sort of PCT filings becoming visible online, and there's tons of new psychedelics in those. And I think people are absolutely going to realize that they can, redeploy these molecules into the gray market. And going back to our earlier point, one thing that I haven't seen happening yet, but which is absolutely imminent once someone figures it out, is that you can deploy, if you have enough money and computing power, you can deploy large scale, virtual screening campaigns against almost any target. What happens when someone does this for opioids, for example? I mean, medically, people have already done it for opioids. Trevena's done it. Brian Kobilka's lab's done it with Scheuchet and Peter Gmeiner in Germany. What happens when the clandestine chemists of the world with a little bit of money behind them realize that you can deploy all of this modern sort of drug discovery technology into sort of whatever end use case you want to make?
Yes, yeah. But I mean, another example would be Field Trip's glutarate ester of 4-hydroxy-DIPT. So, from a
Yeah, right.
medical.
Isoprosin,
Yeah.
or whatever it's termed. Yeah, it's got its own common name now.
Yeah. So, from a medical perspective, not the most interesting thing I've ever seen, although I wish them the best and have nothing against it. But it was a moment where I thought, oh, huh, yeah. Dicarboxylic acid esters. Interesting. That's a type of prodrug that is not prohibited anywhere. That can be applied to all of these now controlled prodrugs. That's just an idea, another little piece of the puzzle. And I think that that's an aspect of this that It's not just basic research. It's not just medicine. All of this stuff ultimately becomes part of our global drug community, for better or worse. It just is inevitable, especially when you think about, like you said, how many of these synthetic cannabinoids were a product of pharmaceutical research that was done at Pfizer. How many of the previous generation of psychedelics were a product of Albert Hofmann's work or Alexander Shulgin's work or the work of Speeder and Anthony at Upjohn, or
the list goes on. Yeah, I don't think chemists are very innovative, whether they're working within the bounds of the law or outside it. And I don't think, you know, prohibition does really nothing to dampen the sort of demand side of the equation. It sometimes slows down the supply side, but humans are, you know, very creative, and chemists are very creative. So the super interesting case for this one is, I guess, that the global market for MDMA. So the traditional route to MDMA, probably as some of your listeners would know, was via isosafrole. You know, safrole can be obtained from sassafras trees. So there were a number of sort of efforts globally to wipe out whole forests of this, you know, tree in Myanmar and elsewhere in Southeast Asia, you know, with disastrous sort of consequences, like ecologically and for those communities. But once that became non-viable, you know, as a source of a raw starting material for MDMA, chemists just came up with a new approach. And, you know, briefly, there's a little blip in global MDMA supply where, you know, things drop off for a little bit and they're back to higher than where they were before very, very quickly. And, you know, the super interesting one is that, yeah, people always find just these loopholes inside the law. One of the more common industrial sort of materials for MDMA manufacture is produced by Darzin condensation of an uncontrolled precursor. So very clever chemistry. Darzin condensation is very, very old stuff. And now, you know, in sort of, you know, drug control circles, people talk about these substances as precursors of a precursor. So this is a material that with just one or two extra steps breaks down into the same thing that you can make from safrole, but is itself not controlled. And there are now, you know, industrial chemical factories in China who don't ask many questions. They know what this stuff's used for, but they're producing it in like multi-ton quantities and sending it all over the world to different clandestine labs. So there will always be solutions to any problem that arises from sort of prohibition of specific compounds or substances or intermediates. There will always be a workaround for those. So, you know, the whole framework in which we attempt to control substances, if that's the aim going forward, probably has to change.
Oh, absolutely. It has so many interesting ramifications. Like you said, the Darzin's reaction was first used to make MDP2P over a century ago.
I'm just looking it up now because I'm curious. I know it's very old. First reported by August George Darzin's in 1904.
Oh, yeah.
It's extremely old chemistry.
Yeah, yeah. So it's really old. And then people talk about it like it's something new, which is, if you look at the literature, that is what is suggested. And then I was even talking to a chemist not so long ago who had been doing that route since the 90s. And just for whatever reason, it never ended up in the forensic historical literature. He actually was arrested for it, and it was known to forensic chemists in the area that he was operating that he was doing that, but it never penetrated the academic literature. And so it was another decade or two before it caught on with the larger chemistry community.
Right. Yeah, there's sort of, I've worked with a number of different government organizations and some of these forensic labs in different parts of the world, mostly in Australia. And yeah, you know, there's some really great chemists there, like that track sort of manufacturing trends. But all of that information is, of course, not shared. It's usually published in internal sort of closed access journals. You know, there's a journal, what is it? The Journal of Investigating Clandestine Laboratory Chemists or something here in Australia. That's like, I once needed an article for a talk that I was preparing and, you know, requested it from my library. And they said, you know, sorry, this is a closed access journal, which is maybe the first journal request that I've ever had that's been denied by my library. So, you know, the information then doesn't penetrate very broadly at all. So it's probably only known in a limited way within forensics labs or enforcement agencies.
Yeah, I mean, I just think that sort of thing is sad. It's the same is true of the DEA microgram, where it was classified, again, actually during the Obama administration. But all of those early publications are historically important. I mean, they're necessary for understanding the drug market at different times in history. And I do think that, well, it's paid for by people's tax money. But I think that outside of taxpayers actually funding this, it's just part of the intellectual commonwealth, and we should be able to reap the benefits of this knowledge.
Yeah, I mean, all knowledge finds a way to be free eventually, right? If there's, demand for it. What the funny thing about Microgram that I always found sort of amusing is that they would never publish synthetic methods. They'll publish analytical data and synthetic routes in general as schematics, but no actual experimental information, as if that's, the hardest part about making any drug, as if that's going to prevent anyone from figuring out how to make a drug, any good chemist.
And even if it did, this is the pattern that they seem to not recognize. Even if they did prevent it, which arguably they made a dent in it, then the industry moves elsewhere to China and India, and it does absolutely nothing in terms of the harms associated with drug use. It just prevents clandestine chemists from having fun in the United States, which is not really the problem.
I see your point.
It's it's sort of like what happened with Operation Web Trip in the United States. It used to be that these compounds would be synthesized in a lab in China. They would import them to the United States, and domestic resellers would sell them on the internet. Then there was this big operation from, I guess, 2002 to maybe 2004, something like that. And they throw the book at these domestic vendors. There was a guy, David Linder, who was sentenced to, I believe, 410 years in prison. He's in prison still to this day and will probably die in prison unless there's some dramatic change in drug policy. And this was for selling research chemicals. So they made it very clear, if you sell these compounds in the United States, we are going to lock you up and throw away the key. So that was the end of the domestic trade. But it did nothing to availability of research chemicals. It just created a direct China to the United States trade route that actually made the drugs cheaper and more available ultimately.
Yeah, that's the, there are a number of sort of enforcement efforts and legislative efforts that lead to these really perverse outcomes that I'm sure are absolutely were not foreseen by the people, enacting these laws or trying to enforce these laws. But it's a pretty common story. It's almost like the perverse outcomes are almost always the result rather than the intended effect.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's just, I would say pretty much every single time that is the case. And you think about all these people making things, even in the gray market, borderline phytocannabinoid world. Like, I guess Delta 8 THC is technically a phytocannabinoid, but it's being produced via chemical modification of CBD. And I don't know, is the hexahydro THC naturally occurring?
Yeah, I suspect almost all of these things occur to some trace extent, except maybe HHC is maybe one. I haven't gone for a specific look. I can get back to you on that by email, Hamilton. But yeah, most of these things do exist in the plant. They're just in trace quantities, right? So I'm fascinated by this sort of unusual legal loophole in a number of states in the US at the moment that like Delta 8 is not explicitly regulated or illegal, therefore it's sort of legal when it's just unregulated. And it's I think there's so many different levels of legislation within the US, from federal all the way down to county, that that there will always be loopholes, right?
And the loopholes are dangerous. I mean, I don't want to oversimplify it, but I had a friend who was a brilliant chemist who died in an explosion making HHC. And there's part of me that just thinks like, oh man, why was he doing such a large scale hydrogenation to make a less potent cannabinoid that was only desirable because it was a legal loophole? That was really the only, as far as I know, that's the only reason to be making HHC. And then someone is dead as a result of it.
Almost all of these compounds, I actually wrote a section for someone to contribute to one of the big WHO meetings on SAR around that region of THC. I think it's actually published in our Dark Classics article on tetrahydrocannabinol. But yeah, the SAR suggests that these compounds, as you move that double bond around or saturate it, delta 9 is pretty optimal. Some other compounds are sort of close in terms of potency, and then others are inactive. So there's really no reason to modify that except for legal loopholes.
Right. Oh man. So are you not doing synthesis at all? But like what is the last time you were making compounds?
Oh, that's I don't know. I'm scared to answer that because I've been sort of managing an academic lab for so long. I haven't lost my hood license. I still know how to operate a separating funnel and a magnetic stirrer hot plate. The last time I probably made an article, a compound, would be, I mean, COVID shut down our lab as well for a little while, so no one was in the lab, but it probably would have been right before sort of COVID took off. We had a super fun experience where for a while we were doing a lot of this cannabinoid SAR work, and I had a colleague, Ryan Vandry, who's a great psychopharmacologist in the cannabis space at Johns Hopkins. He came out and got to make two of his own RV compounds, RV-001 and RV-002. So he was like a, you know, like a school child in the fume hood, just so excited with making new chemical matter. And I think he still uses those photos in a lot of his talks and things, holding up his flask in the air like an excited child. So I think that was the last time I was probably in the lab directly doing a lot of synthesis myself. Yeah, a lot of
I
fun.
mean, I say that because the synthesis work you were doing was so cool. I mean, you were doing it wasn't just cool because it was cannabinoids. It was really also sophisticated from a chemistry perspective, making these cubane derivatives or all of these really strained 7-azonorbornane or also, I mean, I was looking through your dissertation and there's so many cool compounds that you made. It looks like it was a lot of
Yeah,
fun.
it was actually a huge amount of fun, and that's one of the benefits of a PhD. The for the benefit of your listeners, my PhD was in med chem broadly. The specific area was the design and synthesis of these, yeah, very strained and rigid polycyclic cage compounds. And it wasn't all purely academic. They had some legitimate use as ligands for a target called the sigma receptor. So the sigma receptor is actually a target of many approved drugs right now. It's not their main target, but a lot of antipsychotics bind to the sigma receptor, antidepressants. You know, it's sort of a general target for a lot of drugs, a secondary target. And there are a few companies developing ligands for things like neuropathic pain and cocaine addiction at the moment, targeting this site. But one of the consequences of doing this work was that, yeah, I was making some just pretty wacky compounds that, you know, really have no right to exist. Things like cubane, where you take a, you know, eight carbon atoms and turn them into a box way past their typical bond angles. It's pretty fun. And I've seen online explosions and fire that YouTuber is trying to do this at home in his garage. So I'm pretty keen to speak to him about one of these key 2+2 photocyclization steps, because I had a lot of trouble getting that to work in a well-equipped synthetic chemistry laboratory. So I don't know how well he's going to go with a reptile lamp and a garage.
Yeah, tell me about that. I mean, I've been sort of, I mean, I remember trying to talk to Philip Eaton when I was at UChicago and he wouldn't talk to me, but I was so impressed by the original cubane synthesis because it's like
Oh,
this
it's amazing.
molecular origami. It's really like
Yeah.
something that it's really just incredibly beautiful. And at the same time, the product is so simple. I mean, Philip Eaton was convinced that eventually people would figure out a way to make a tetramerization of acetylene to make cubane, because he thought that this was going to be a vital compound that people would be filling their cars with cubane as fuel.
Yeah, it's beautiful synthesis. It's I know the exact article you're talking about. I think it's Eaton from 74 or 76 in Journal of Organic Chemistry. And it's the sort of thing where if you designed it on paper and showed it to your colleagues in chemistry, they'd just tell you outright that like that thing can't exist and you'll never be able to make it. And he persisted with it for a really long time to prove that it was, you know, possible. And it's pretty remarkable. And people have gone on to do a lot of work with cubanes now. It's being deployed in a number of ways as a bioisosteer for benzene, so something that has the same sort of occupation of space as a benzene ring, but is not aromatic. And as a result, people have started substituting it with a lot of different things. They've made explosives with it. They've used it in quite a few different drug analogs as a way to improve their profiles and things. So yes, super interesting sort of class of molecules.
Yeah. And the other thing, I mean, I guess the use of these things as fuels never panned out, but I was reading this interview with Philip Eaton and he was saying that it used to be the case in racing that it wasn't just about the race car driver or the car, but you were allowed to use whatever fuel you wanted. So there was a huge chemistry component in terms of people working with chemists to compete to create the best possible fuel. So people were using things like quadricyclane as a fuel in race cars. And it's kind of a shame that that era died out, because this is another example of how some weird industry like race car driving can have a useful impact on science. Like I bet if NASCAR allowed that sort of thing, maybe we would have the method for the tetramerization of acetylene to produce cubane.
Oh yeah, I think the limits there, the reason probably a lot of that work disappeared is just that it's pretty dangerous designing new fuels. They have a tendency to become potentially like uncontrollably combustible or explosive. I don't know if you've read that book Ignition about the history of, you know, the rocket fuel industry ultimately in the US.
I have, but not for years.
It's so interesting. The number of like very, very serious industrial accidents in that book is, you know, is enough to make you understand why this work is no longer done so routinely.
Oh.
There still are a few groups. I'm trying to think what the exact structure was. It was a phosphorus and nitrogen containing compound, only those two substances, and with more atoms of each than any molecule has a right to contain. And it was produced by a German university, and the affiliation of the authors was the High Energy Products Division. And I remember reading this as a grad student, just thinking, like, this is wild. It was like, I'll see if I can find it and send it to you. But the experimental section is, you know, the chemist donned their Kevlar gloves and bulletproof vest and stood behind the explosives chamber to make like a few milligrams of this thing that might blow up in your face at any moment. Absolutely wild.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the same is also, of course, true with chemical weapons. Like, have you ever seen this book,
yeah,
State Secrets by Vil Mirzayanov?
No, but I'm going to make a note right now to look that up.
It's about development of the Novichok agents. And right. I haven't read it for years, but as I recall, it's full of these sort of casual references to people dying. Like that year, three chemists died while we were working on it because there was a leak in a seal in one of the experimental chambers. Just like, oof. That was just part of life, working on those compounds.
Yeah, I gave this a lot of thought as a grad student, as I was moving into sort of strain polycycles. And you know, there's you can find all sorts of accidents in research. Organomercuries are another field where there's been some pretty famous accidents.
Right.
And I just decided that, like, I love science and I love chemistry, but it's probably not worth dying for. So I tend to avoid anything that's especially risky unless it's absolutely necessary for molecular design or synthesis.
Right. Things like ketone, are you familiar with that?
No.
It was a popular insecticide in the US in, I guess, the 1950s. It was what inspired Philip Eaton to make cubane. It's like...
Right, I'm just looking at it now. That's a whole lot of chlorine atoms.
Yeah, and you look at that and you think, wow, anyone that works in a ketone factory is definitely going to die. And I think many people did die, but Philip Eaton worked with that stuff and did not die. So there is, I guess, there's a lot of people that get hurt, and then there's also a remarkable number of people that somehow don't get hurt.
It's pretty wild. You know, are you familiar with the concept of radiation hormesis?
Yes, I am. Yes.
This idea that, you know, a little bit of radiation is actually good for you. And of course, we can never disprove it because no one on Earth has ever lived in a zero radiation environment. We have radiation in the air from radon things. We have radiation, background radiation from rocks, cosmic radiation. But I do wonder if there is, you know, some element of sort of synthetic chemical hormesis as well, because I've heard so many stories about these, you know, older, now retired academics who, because it was just sort of standard practice at the time, would routinely wash their hands after working in the lab with benzene to wash off all the other chemical matter, you know. And some of these chemists live to be like 90 years old or older. So I do wonder if it's probably just individual genetics and a number of other things. But yeah, people certainly work with some pretty dangerous agents and live to a very old age. I mean, Shulgin probably ingested more new chemical matter than almost anyone on Earth, and, you know, lived well into his, what was it, 80s or 90s?
80s,
when he died.
Yeah.
80s, yeah. Yeah, and pretty good life right up until the end.
Yeah, it might just be wishful thinking on my part, but I certainly have wondered about the same thing, the possibility that continuous low-level exposure to poisons working in a synthetic organic chemistry lab could ultimately be beneficial.
it's an interesting idea. I don't know if anyone's looked at it. There are certainly environmental contaminants and some chemical classes that have, you know, well-defined mechanisms of toxicity, and they're known not to be good at any level. But for everything else, you know, I mean, the body is ultimately just sort of a xenobiotic flesh sack. That's really all we're designed to do, is to prevent things from, you know, reaching our critical organs with all these xenobiotic processes, antibiotic metabolism processes. So like, small amounts of anything, we are designed to deal with that as organisms.
Right. And for all the talk about chemical contamination of our environment with plasticizers and drug metabolites, or historically things like DDT, I think on another level, our environments are spectacularly sterile compared to the way that they would have been pre-industrialization. Like, just in terms of how much smoke inhalation a normal person would have experienced, at least if they were, living in an environment where they had to burn wood or coal to keep their home warm and to cook their food, it would have been absolutely enormous amounts.
There's a yeah, there's a huge element of sort of willful delusion to a lot of discussion around environmental impact. And if you look at, a lot of people, a huge number of people in Africa still heat their homes and prepare their food indoors with combustible materials. And the health consequences from that alone that are removed, as soon as you have things like coal-fired power plants, not the best source of energy, but there is some trade-off there in terms of health benefit, for sure. Yeah, I think, people don't think in a really balanced sort of long view way about what the world would have been like before a lot of these technologies were developed.
And not even that, but I think there's obviously an enormous amount of evidence that these things are bad for you. But I also can't help but wonder if on some, have you seen these this research on various inflammatory bowel disorders being less common in undeveloped countries, and the hypothetical explanation is that there's more parasitic infection, and that
I haven't seen
it
that.
may actually have an anti-inflammatory effect, or it may inhibit things like Crohn's or ulcerative colitis.
Wow, that's so interesting. There are certainly a lot of, diseases of the modern world that seem to be a result of the various ways in which we live. And obviously we've changed the natural world an enormous amount. But some of these technologies are going to be extremely good for human health and longevity, and that's what the data says in terms of the number of people now living out of poverty and the average, human lifespan and all of these things. And yeah, maybe there is some benefit to routinely being infected with various parasites as well for other conditions. It's just a very complex situation, right? Very hard to do these experiments in a controlled way.
Yeah, I mean, I have psoriasis, and one of the most effective treatments is coal tar.
Yeah, I also use coal tar for a, psoriasis-like condition that pops up sporadically that's hasn't even been properly diagnosed.
And I think, and there's pretty strong evidence that at least it has the potential to be carcinogenic. It's not clear that topical use of coal tar in people with psoriasis is associated with cancer. I've looked at it pretty carefully, so it doesn't seem like it's probably not ideal. But again, it makes me wonder, well, were people just being exposed to such a large volume of polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons historically that this is almost like a deprivation of it that we're experiencing in the modern world?
Coal tar deficiency.
I mean, it sounds crazy, but if people were continuously burning fires, which presumably my ancestors were, if they're from Europe, they probably were getting a good dose of these polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, and maybe that's just something that we evolved to be in the presence of over, however many generations.
These are all the great unknowns, right? Because we have evolved for a very specific environment that doesn't look an enormous amount like the environment that we currently live in. I think people sort of forget that. And that's not to say that the things that we've done in terms of technological development or the ways in which we've changed the world are bad. Some of them certainly are bad, and we can show that. But look at what's happened to sort of, any measure of human health. It's very hard to argue on a large scale globally that, human health has been hindered by any of these things that we've done. I think it's just striking that balance between understanding the consequences of a given technology, and, attempting to mitigate the harms.
Right. And back to cubane. So you were trying to make psychoactive cubane derivatives, the dream.
I was. I never got that far with it, but there's this idea that if you know the structure of amphetamine, where its benzene ring is, there is a cyclohexyl version of that, right? So what's it called? Is it what's the name of that molecule? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, it's
Hexadrine, propylhexadrine, something like
Yep.
this. So So this is a saturated version of amphetamine. So you've got a cyclohexane in place of a benzene. And one of these ideas I had for a long time was that, what happens, and people are now doing it, I think I shared with you Craig Williams' work from Queensland here. He's looked at replacing a bunch of aromatic rings in drugs with cubane. But I had this idea that, what happens if you take out, I mean, even the simple, it's an amylamine derivative that's also a stimulant. So if you even remove parts of that cyclohexane ring, you retain stimulant activity. So I got curious about what would happen if you replace the benzene ring with a cubane. So you'd get these sort of corresponding cubephetamine. And by logical extension, I don't know if the same is true in the US, but here we call enantiomeric methamphetamine. It's referred to as ice on the streets. So my sort of tongue-in-cheek idea was that if you could make that compound as well, that derivative, you'd have ice cubephetamine and ice cube. But I only pushed the chemistry so far. So you can make a monofunctionalized cubane and install an aldehyde there, and I'd done that. Every sort of version of a Henry reaction at that site didn't really work that well, but this was also sort of right as I was finishing my PhD and I was pretty busy doing other things. So I still think it can be done, but I haven't gone back to look at it, to be honest. It's, thrown out there for any chemists who are listening to have a crack at making it as a sort of interesting
Do you
molecule.
have any insight into why the Henry reaction didn't work?
Yeah, when I was doing some reaction searching for precedent, looking at a sort of analogous situation like a tert-butyl carbaldehyde, those sorts of aldehydes tended not to react under most typical Henry reaction conditions or, other nitroaldol conditions. So my suspicion is that it's just a little bit too hindered. And there's certainly, there's a million other ways you could sort of homologate that carbon and install an amine eventually. So yeah, feel free to send me an email if you want to discuss it some more, but there's certainly many routes to it.
I mean, that's what I love is on one hand, you have these things that sound kind of ridiculous, like making the cube phetamine or installing these exotic atoms like silicon into something. And it sounds, sort of ridiculous, but this is really how new things are discovered. And that's sort of my favorite thing is as much as I love this idea of ultra sophisticated in silico drug design where we, use the state of the art technology to discover the most perfect psychedelic, I still have this romantic suspicion that it will be Shulgin type non-hypothesis
Yeah.
driven following of whims that will create something new and useful.
Yeah, I think there's absolutely some really interesting work to be done there. Yeah, the two that are used in already in preclinical drug dev at least are carbon for silicon replacement and the use of boron in various ways. So boron is one of these like really interesting elements that we use synthetically all the time as a convenient handle for a lot of very modern synthetic chemistry. But it's surprisingly non-toxic, like borax eyewash is stuff you literally put in your eyes to clean them. It's a pretty non-toxic element, and people have only just started playing around with it as a sort of feature of drugs. There's been a few sort of niche areas where people have looked at incorporating into organic structures for things like boron neutron capture therapy. That's actually what my undergrad final research year was on. But yeah, other than that, it hasn't found sort of widespread application yet.
Right. And do you have any insight into the Australian market in particular? Because both underground and above ground, because Australia is always interesting in that it's isolated. So there's more of an emphasis on synthetic drugs because of the difficulty of importing things like cocaine. Some of the weirder drug trends that I've seen have been in Australia. I think Australia is the only place that I'm aware of where there has been, you might be familiar with this paper. I think it was a methamphetamine lab that was using bioreactors to produce, I'm trying to remember the name of this compound. It wasn't methamphetamine, but it was something, and it wasn't P2P, but it was something similar. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No, I don't know the specific work, but yeah, that's a whole, I mean, that's almost another sort of hour of conversation right there is once clandestine chemists start using modern synthetic biology approaches to make interesting things, that's going to be a really interesting development in the drug world.
Oh yeah, and it's one of these things that people always ask me about. Why isn't there a yeast to make psilocybin? Why isn't there a yeast to make methamphetamine? Why isn't there a yeast to make morphine or LSD. And I think, you know, why not? People should try, but it's never been the area that interests me most. But seeing that somebody had actually done it in Australia was so fascinating. And then also you have the example of 4-methylaminorex, I think, was also used to some extent in Australia. Is that correct?
I can't speak specifically to that. I know every now and again there are, I mean, there's sort of historical records for some of Shulgin's compounds appearing here occasionally. Shulgin himself, in Pikal, I think it is, he talks about being an expert witness at a legal case in Australia, one of his compounds had appeared. But yeah, we do have an unusual drug market here. I think if you turn to sources like the Global Drug Survey, there's a lot of really interesting info there that's unique to Australia. We love cannabis, apparently. You know, we have one of the highest per capita uses of cannabis in the world. We have one of the highest prices for cocaine and some of the lowest quality, and that makes a lot of sense given our geographic isolation. And generally, I know from speaking to forensics colleagues, there's been a bit of a decline in onshore manufacture of any synthetic drugs. It's certainly not a big deal here. It seems like almost everything's coming in, and I'm not sure why that is, but probably a mix of sort of enforcement, control of various precursors, the fact that we don't have a particularly porous border because we're an island state, but it tends to be pretty cheap just to import amphetamines from various parts of Southeast Asia. So I think almost all of the drugs here are imported, with the exception maybe of cannabis.
Okay, yes, I found what I was thinking of. It was somebody that was using yeast to ferment glucose in the presence of benzaldehyde to produce phenylacetylcarbenol, which is like beta hydroxy P2P.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
And then presumably doing reductive amination, as far as I know. So that was actually done.
Interesting. Was this illegal? Is it illegal for any reason? Were they prosecuted?
They were caught, and they were prosecuted for synthesis of methamphetamine, but I don't know that the phenylacetylcarbenol was illegal outside of whatever.
Right. So they already had an amphetamine lab running, and then they had some naughty yeast on the side.
Yes.
But that's not why they're in trouble. Yes. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, there are a number of people, the synthetic biology world I followed a little bit from the cannabis space. You know, you've got a ton of companies now using synthetic biology to make various advanced natural products. Christina Smolk's lab at Stanford, of course, has done the proof of concept for production of morphine from glucose in modified yeast. Multiple people have done it now for psilocybin, which is a relatively simple molecule that's probably a little bit genetically closer to yeast anyway in terms of its original organism. I think that's another thing that's sort of only a matter of time. The proof of concept has already been done. It's all just engineering and optimization at this point. So I think for sure there will be some point in the future where, especially thinking about how off the shelf some of the reagents needed for synthetic biology are compared to chemistry, how accessible they are. I think it's very likely that, you know, in future there will absolutely be sort of homebrew, psychedelic yogurt and other things for sure.
And this, of course, leads into the ever-present issue of whether natural things are somehow superior to synthetic things, which is the basis.
Oh no! I've been stupidly online this week talking about this exact thing. I have this bizarre memory disorder where I bring up things that are apparently quite inflammatory online, then forget that I've done so and repeat the mistake a little bit later. So the one that absolutely sends me online is the entourage effect, which I know we've spoken about a bit. It's now leaking into the psychedelics world. But I was stupid enough, I think it was just yesterday, to post a tweet that said, the entourage effect is just astrology for pharmacologists. And it's been received with some contention by the Twittersphere.
Well, I saw some of the responses, and they were, like so many of these things, fundamentally confused. They were saying things like, are you saying that the combination of beta carbolines and DMT and ayahuasca is astrology for pharmacologists? And it's like, well, that's not the entourage effect. That's a combination of two different plants that have a well-established complementary effect. This is not the idea that a number of different trace components acting in concert will be greater than the sum of their parts.
Yeah, my position on this, as some, you know, the other comment I get is, you know, have you even done any research in this area? So clearly people can't spend 2 minutes to Google my name or anything else about me, but I have done research in this area. My position comes from that research, where both directly and in collaboration with other scientists. We've gone looking for entourage at the receptor level. We've done a lot of analysis of sort of the compounds that are found in cannabis and their individual targets. And the goalposts just keep shifting, right? So you can show that there's very unlikely to be a direct sort of receptor level interaction between terpenes and any cannabinoid, between different cannabinoids. This makes total sense when you think about the cannabis plant. You know, it produces some 450 different compounds that are presumably bioactive terpenoid-derived substances. Very few of those have anything even close to nanomolar engagement with any of the hundreds of GPCRs that we've looked at. So the idea that you would take for amounts of material that are in the doses that are used by humans, that you could take something with like less than a percent expression of this plant with no reported activity at anything that would make physiological sense, and somehow these things are just going to magically combine and give you an enhanced effect. It's just when it's explained by simpler things, right? When it's explained more easily under sort of Occam's razor principles by just human subjectivity. I mean, it's just such a reach. Like it's sort of like a bizarre cognitive Rube Goldberg machine.
Yes, and it's as if people, it's bizarre because this is often coming from spiritual people, and yet this is a hyper materialist interpretation that completely neglects to recognize human psychology. They talk about these
Yeah, that
things as if it's all a product of the chemical identity of the different components and forget the enormous contribution that their own prejudices and preconceived ideas and hopes about these substances play into the experience.
Oh, it's absolutely just so confusing to me. I don't understand it. I was reading recently after we discussed this last time about the origin of this term, and it seems to go back to this quite famous identity in the cannabis world, Dr. Ethan Russo. So he's a neurologist by training. He's a clinical scientist, not a preclinical scientist. Very smart guy. He's been heavily involved in the cannabis space for a long time, but he seems to be one of the first people to sort of broadly popularized this idea of the entourage effect. And if you look at other things that he's been involved in, he's running a company that sort of seeks to optimize disharmony in the endocannabinoid system, the ECS. And I was just checking out their website before because I wanted to make sure I had my facts right. And it's the name of this company is Credo. The website, let me see if I can find it here. But on the website itself, it says something like, yeah, Credo Science is what it is. And it's on their website they have in Latin, Credo means I believe. We maintain that, quote, the proof is out there for cannabis slash hemp based solutions for better living. I'm like, that's not science. That's religion. You know, you can't just believe. Like, the proof may be out there, but you can't. It's one of the most frustrating things about the entourage effect is this idea of sort of moving goalposts. So no matter what you, and I totally understand that, absence of evidence is not evidence of absence, but you can only spend so much time failing to prove a hypothesis. And like lots of scientists have spent a lot of time and money trying to show various reasons that maybe whole cannabis extracts is more useful than a given individual substance. And no one's found anything thus far except for human anecdotal reports. And everyone's very quick to discount the contribution of humans to those reports and any sort of findings. It's really quite strange.
Yeah, and you're far more aware of this literature than I am. So, what is the current consensus on CBD and its interaction with THC? Is there anything of significance there?
So CBD, that there is one feasible interaction whereby CBD in some systems, these contrived cellular systems, is a sort of functional antagonist at very low potency of CB1. So presumably, sure, maybe there's some interaction between THC and CBD, and I think that's about where it ends. When you look at a lot of the compounds in cannabis, these are phenolic natural products. We know that polyphenols from things like grapefruit have massive pharmacodynamic implications. So they can actually impact your metabolic enzymes and therefore affect how your body responds to other classes of drugs that need those enzymes for metabolism. So the only interactions that I think are feasible are maybe pharmacodynamic ones. And we've done a little bit of work in this space as well. But taking CBD every day at very high doses, like it is used in a properly prescribed medical way for things like epilepsy, does seem to modify your sort of ability to metabolize the other epileptic drugs that you are being prescribed and taking every day. So there is some sort of benefit there in a pharmacodynamic sense, but this idea that, some trace cannabinoid, cannabivarin is going to interact with myrcene or some other terpene in a way that's like actually physiologically relevant from the plant, given that these are all trace compounds apart from THC, CBD, and maybe CBG. It's just there's no evidence for it really. There's pretty limited evidence of some very limited specific effects with a few key compounds, and that's it.
Right. And what about the idea that raw cannabis with the non-decarboxylated THC has some kind of superior health benefit, and it's our meddling with the plant in smoking it that is stripping it of its activity? Is there any evidence that THC acid exerts an anti-inflammatory effect or any desirable activity?
Yeah, there is some evidence for that actually. The issue is that these compounds are inherently very unstable. So that's an area where there probably is more research to be done. It's certainly valid. There is limited preclinical evidence for this idea that THCA is anti-inflammatory in various ways, but the molecule so rapidly degrades to its sort of decarboxylated THC, and the same is true for most of these acids, in fact, that it's just very hard to study them. So the effects that you're observing, unless you're very careful to control those, which most studies don't, you're probably observing effects that derive from both THC and THCA, for example. So it's very, very hard to do those experiments, but there's certainly more work to be done there.
When you're talking about instability, are you talking about metabolic instability?
No, sorry, physical instability. So, I've worked with some of these acids, both synthetically and for analysis and things, and for pharmacological evaluation. And, in drug development, we aim for drugs and intermediates that are sort of bench stable, ideally, especially sort of lead candidates and clinical candidates. They need to be able to sit around in some salt form or as a free base on a bench stably for months at a time. They need to have good shelf life. This is absolutely not true for a lot of natural products. It's definitely not true for cannabinoid acids. So these things, you can store various cannabinoid acids in a freezer at minus 30 degrees Celsius and then go back and try to use them like 2 weeks later, and that you will see evidence of degradation. And that's when they're kept under the best conditions. So they're just not very stable. Once they're expressed by the plant, they're degrading constantly.
Yeah, it's complicated because on one hand, it's one of these things where, sure, I could see it. It's possible that such a thing is true, but the evidence is missing. And I think that a lot of people are doing this for the wrong reasons. So, if people are saying, okay, the trace, there was that paper that came out, like the MALDI MS analysis of maybe it was Psilocybe mexicana, where they found like 1 microgram of Harman or something, and then people are talking about how the beta carbolene present in the mushroom is producing a sort of ayahuasca type effect. And it's really clear to me that this is wishful thinking, but then at the same time, it wouldn't blow my mind if there were something. It just doesn't seem like people really know what it is, and it doesn't seem like it seems like it's coming from a place of desire for it to be true, not evidence.
Yeah, absolutely. It's from sort of an wishful thinking perspective, and that's fine. Do the experiments to the best ability that you can, but when you continue, ceaselessly to find nothing, don't keep making a case that this is likely important. That's what I find really infuriating. No matter how much evidence you present that these things don't do much, someone will always come back with a poorer experiment or, some other way to look at it, another angle. This one that came up in those comments on Twitter was like, oh, terpenes do nothing, huh? And then they post this study from Scientific Reports that I've read in detail. It's a pretty bad study. It's looking at a number of terpenes that are administered by IP injection in mice at doses of 50 to 200 milligrams per kilogram. So to give people an idea of how much that is, it's the equivalent of injecting a human with 3.5 to 14 grams of a terpene oil. And of course that's going to do something. I mean, you're changing your body's physiology in a really non-specific way. It's probably going to do something, but they talk about it as if this is a very specific effect. But you're talking about food level amounts of a substance, not drug level amounts of a substance.
Right. Yeah. I have a feeling there's going to be a lot more of this in the future. I don't see any less of it. I mean, there's a startup now that has a cell culture for Buchwald variceus that I actually am going to, I think, go visit it. I'm sort of curious about what they're doing. They claim it's a full spectrum biosynthesis of all of the components in Buchwald variceus venom. And there's part of me that thinks, okay, so you're producing cardiotoxic steroids, and that's going to be received as if it is a great innovation. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting that they were able to pull it off, and there's no question that there are people out there that desperately want that.
Yeah, it's really strange. I mean, nature it comes from this bizarre anthropocentric view as well, as if, an opium poppy has just been hanging out, just waiting for humans to come along because it's been making this beautiful analgesic agent for us to use. It comes from the fact that, we've co-evolved with so many different organisms in this sort of biologically active, rich chemical space. Of course, we're going to end up just by chance with molecules that have sort of some complementarity in terms of common receptors and things. But this idea that, like, the natural source of something is going to, opium poppy is actually another great example. It produces all sorts of things that are like quite toxic to humans. The idea that a plant or a toad or anything else, a fungus, is going to produce something that's just perfectly optimized for human use, and anytime we try to do anything else to it, we're just ruining it. It's so bizarre to me.
Yes.
It's the exception, not the rule. Very few compounds that are found in nature have ever been approved as medicines outright on their own without any modification. They're definitely the exceptions. There's plenty of compounds that have taken their inspiration from nature in some sense. I think about two-thirds of all drugs have some natural product heritage, is what they call it, depending on how you define that. That includes cases where just the initial mechanism was discovered by a natural product and a completely new drug was made. But there's definitely natural product heritage there for a lot of these drugs, but it's very, very exceptionally rare for something that nature produces to be perfectly suited for human use in its natural form.
Yeah. And I think you really hit the nail on the head with the anthropocentrism because, again, these tend to be people who are very into nature. They want to appreciate the natural world, the beauty of nature, and yet they're treating nature as if it exists exclusively for us, that mushrooms do everything to teach us, and cannabis does everything to heal us. And
It's a really simple like marriage of convenience in a lot of cases, I suspect. Michael Pollan's written the most elegantly about this, I think, for a popular audience. So if you can check out his book Botany of Desire if you haven't read it, it's an amazing book. It's one of I think it's the first Michael Pollan book I read way before he was sort of as famous as he was now, as he is now, sorry. And he uses a few case examples, apples, opium, tulips as a sort of visually beautiful flowering plant. But his basic argument is that if you're a plant and you're competing with other plants in your environment, and you make something that's like pretty useful to the organisms around you, if one of those organisms happens to be like a sort of upright hominid that's spreading all across the globe, then it's definitely in your interest to do something to attract that animal. If it's more effective as a way of continued existence than a bird eating your seeds or whatever, it makes a lot of sense that we're going to co-evolve. And we've seen this with cannabis. Like it's not that it's a magical medicinal plant. It's that it gets you super stoned. And people in Central Asia are probably like, oh, this is amazing. Like, some of my pain's gone away. I'm pretty high. This is great. Like, whatever the, 12,000-year-old Central Asian equivalent is of getting blazed on the couch, that's definitely a contributor to the reason that cannabis is so popular today. And I'd argue that, there's species of liverwort, for example, in New Zealand, these radula species that produce cannabimetic compounds that look a little bit like THC, that are definitely psychoactive. But they're not as obviously psychoactive in their natural form as cannabis is, and that's probably the reason that they haven't spread all over the earth. It's purely about where these things can grow, how useful they are to humans, how likely we are to spread them. And I'd argue that if cannabis had slightly less THC in it and you couldn't really extract it in an effective way as a primitive human, it wouldn't have gone anywhere. It'd just be another isolated shrub that exists in Central Asia, and that's it.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, I agree. That's great. I mean, this is, are there other things? I mean, there's an infinite number of things to talk about, but are there other things that you think we should touch on?
Oh, I mean, not, yeah, just an endless list, but I think we've covered a huge amount in Hamilton. So, yeah, thanks a bunch for having me on.
Yeah, no, thanks for talking to me. And I wish you luck with your new endeavor. I'm really excited to see what comes out of this. And I hope, like, one thing that worries me is the kind of anger that exists around this world with people who are fundamentally oriented toward the same goal. I guess it's sort of a classic narcissism of small differences issue. But, I think that this is a good thing that so many people are now finding the opportunity to push forward understanding of psychedelics. And I'm just, I'm so excited that Mike Cunningham is doing this and that I'm doing it and you're doing it. And I think really good stuff is going to become available in the coming years.
Oh, absolutely. I think most of the people that I know at sort of a development level, I'm not talking about people on the investment side necessarily, although there's a lot of good people there as well, but most of the people I've had direct interactions with in this space, the things they talk about are not making money. They talk about, mental illness and like the desire for fundamentally new solutions. So I think it's people are not motivated by greed here necessarily. I'm sure there are a few of those people too, but it's really about, the ability to make a difference here. And that's certainly why I got into it. I've lost, way too many friends and acquaintances to suicide. I've watched people struggle with various forms of depression that are just not currently treatable. So, yeah, that's the dream for Silo, is that we're trying to come up with, some really creative new solutions that will hopefully improve human health.
Yeah. Well, that sounds great.